developing that one project, that one standout thing you're doing, what is that for you? And, you know, if you're starting out relatively early, it's okay if it's cringe. One of the main purposes is to just show people you have the initiative and the motivation to seek those kinds of things out yourself and to do them. But what is that? And if you don't have one, why aren't you making it?
This is Audience of One, and I'm your host, Spencer Keir. This podcast is a venue for me to follow my curiosity through conversations with leading thinkers and builders. My guest today is Dwarkesh Patel. Dwarkesh is the creator of the Lunar Society newsletter and podcast. We talk about curiosity, talent, podcasting and research, status games, finding what to work on, and AI and futurism. Please enjoy.
For the average college student who's feeling a sense of boredom, especially during COVID, that wouldn't necessarily mean they go out and start a podcast. They'd probably spend their time elsewhere. So I'm curious why you felt compelled in that direction, that you wanted to go and create something, do something a little bit more, quote unquote, productive with your time.
Yeah, I think a lot of kids probably did start something and maybe they just fizzled. Or I remember one of the things that got me kind of interested in this kind of thing was one of my good friends in college was really into football. And so he had a fantasy football YouTube channel that was doing amazing. It was like tens of thousands of subscribers. And he was like making a shit ton of money off of it too. Fantasy football wasn't my thing. So I was thinking like, what am I into? And you know, I like reading books. I like reading papers. I like discussing ideas. And so that seemed like a natural jumping off point. And it ended up being much simpler than I thought to send out an email to a professor I only knew by reputation, somebody who I thought of as a famous public intellectual, and ask them, hey, do you have an hour? Here are some questions I would ask you just to prove I'm not an idiot. And then you can get them on the call and you can just talk to these people who are kind of like your heroes. Or in my case, they were, you know, my intellectual heroes.
The thing I keep telling people who are interested in starting a podcast is that it's the equivalent of saying, hey, can I pick your brain for 30 minutes, but with a little bit more weight behind it and yep. Like rigor. And the response rate like triples as a result of it. So I almost encourage everyone to have a podcast.
Yeah, no, it's a great excuse to get to meet all these people.
Exactly.
I think before I started it, I didn't even have a name for the podcast. And so I just recorded my first episode with Brian Kaplan. He's this economist. And yeah, and then afterwards, I'm like, I got to call this something. but honestly, to get started, it was just like a webcam or something is all it takes.
Exactly. So I think it's one thing to start with the podcast. But I think the statistic is like something like 95 or 99% of podcasts fall off after the 20th episode. And it's also to add another layer in the mix for somebody who is about to enter the workforce or is at the age of entering the workforce. All of your friends, I imagine, were going and getting jobs, but you decided to continue down this path. What was maybe like if there was any dissonance at that time, what was that like and how did you kind of overcome that and decide this is the thing I'm going to stick with rather than falling into the well-worn path?
This is a good question, by the way. I appreciate that. So I graduated about a semester early and at the time, a lot of my friends were still in college. So then it kind of felt like I graduated too early and I thought, well, I've got 6 months to kill basically. And that gave me an opportunity to keep doing this stuff, which I might not have felt comfortable doing if I'm like official graduated walked, because walks only happen in the spring. Anyway, so I do that and I'm planning on only doing that for a few months. And then a big event happened in the history of the podcast, let's say. One of my blog posts went viral and got the attention of some people I really respect and are famous. And so at that point, I'm like, fuck, we got to keep doing this. We got to keep doing this a few more months. And since then, until very recently, it's been a story of, I think, me thinking to myself, I'm going to quit this. I'm going to do this for a few more months. And I say that to myself every few months until like some other big thing happens. And now I've gotten to the point where I'm committed to this and I think I can really grow this 10x or beyond. And I really want to see how far I can take this.
When that doubt creeps into your mind, why is that? Because from somebody like I have a podcast with, you know, hundreds of listeners. Some of your episodes have gotten hundreds of thousands of listens. To me, you've made it. You've gotten the eye of Mark Andreessen and Jeff Bezos, et cetera. Why does that doubt kind of still creep in, and how do you overcome that?
Yeah. Well, sometimes it's helpful. Sometimes the doubt in my mind was that, well, first of all, there was doubt in the sense that, can I make, because you were just giving the statistics on the podcast, right? Like there's a lot of them, most of them are not that famous. But the main thing in my mind was, I've studied computer science. I think of myself as a technical guy, and I want to do something useful in this world, like writing code, building a business, maybe even digging ditches. Like, what are we doing here? Just talking back and forth. And especially if it's not going to be to a huge audience, because at that point you can sort of make up a story of like, I'm spreading ideas or whatever. But then if it's like a small audience, like, who are you spreading ideas to? So yeah, it was just a story of like the opportunity cost of what I could be doing instead.
Why do you feel that those other pursuits, where you're building a product or service, are maybe more worthwhile or valuable? Or do you still feel that way, I guess, is the first question. And second, why?
Yeah, so part of it is, there's probably a few reasons. One is I kind of got really interested in college in the Paul Graham essays. And I'm not sure if your listeners are maybe familiar with him, but basically he's, I'm sure they are, right? He was a creator of Y Combinator and writes essays about startups. And so I got really interested in him and had this idea that, oh, I should do a startup. And that's always kind of what I imagined would be my path. And so it felt weird. You know, you're introducing yourself to people and they're like, what do you do? And you're like, I'm a podcaster. And then they're like, what you podcast about what? And I'm like, you know, I interview people. I try to ask you questions. Now you can get away with a little bit if you have, I've interviewed people like XXX or X or Y or Z. In the beginning, you're like, you shouldn't be doing something with your time, man. You have a computer science degree. What are you doing? So that's kind of where the doubt came from.
And do you still have, and obviously you're incredibly young. If you think of your life in like multiple 5 or 10 year chunks, you have plenty of time to do everything you want to do. Mm-hmm. Are you still feeling like in the near or medium term, you do want to go build something? And if so, maybe what are some of the problems or the big quests you're tossing around?
In the medium to long term is so hard to say, especially when you are young. Any plan I would have made even 6 months ago would have been terrible, let alone 3 years ago. I would have never considered starting a podcast with the goal of making that my main thing. At the time, it was a way of killing time or just doing something fun on the side. So I'm trying right now to just see in the immediate future, 6 to 12 months in the future, what can I do there? And I think there's a lot of room for me to just learn a lot of things, which I have been doing, grow the podcast a lot, develop my own ideas, and basically do what I've done over the last year, but have that same magnitude of growth again. And at that point, I think more options will become clear. It'll become more clear if this is, is this a game you can win at that point? That's kind of the plan.
I think sitting with that uncertainty or that knowledge that the plan might change relatively soon, or any plans you do make are subject to change, can be difficult to sit with. So it's very commendable. I've noticed.
What do you think of that plan?
I think that's great. I think a lot of people would envy being in that situation where you do have, I don't want to call it the luxury, but like you've put yourself in a position where you've established a reputation. I think you are starting to monetize your podcast as well. I don't know if that's, if that's at least paying the bills for you, then you've created infinite runway. So I would absolutely see this to its end. And again, you have no idea what opportunities are going to arise 6 to 12 months down the road.
One thing I've been thinking recently is if I did stop it to do something else, you know, to build the GPT wrapper or something, and when I'm 30, I'm going to ask myself, hey, remember that time I was 22 and I had this podcast, I was interviewing like the smartest people in the world, and like, I just stopped. That was weird.
Yeah, I mean, you could even go back 2 years ago when you would have when it was the crypto craze and everybody was trying to build something in blockchain, and you would feel that exact same way maybe today. So I think there's more staying power with what you're doing. One of the unique characteristics I think you have is, it's very common nowadays to talk about this idea of like curiosity and letting your curiosity be your guide. And in some ways people might call that privileged, but I think we're both in the position to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. Why is it that, I guess, first, would you say that kind of your curiosity is the guiding force or kind of top of the value stack for you? And the kind of like a microcosm of this is, just a second ago, you asked, you're in an interview here with me, I'm asking you questions and you turn the question back on me and ask, what do you think about my plan? Like, you are persistently trying to learn and improve and gain more knowledge and wisdom. Where does that come from? And why aren't more people like that?
Yeah. Is curiosity my drive, and why aren't more people curious?
Or why don't they lead with their curiosity? Because I would say a lot of people are curious, but maybe they suppress it. And that's a whole different line of questioning we can get into. But I think you are uniquely good at leading with that, or driving with your curiosity.
I think one thing about curiosity is, in and of itself, of course, it's a virtue, but it's one that... one whose effectiveness is increased the more you practice it. I wouldn't personally listen to any of my episodes I've done before the last year or something. And it just, because there's a lot of things I didn't know before then, the questions I would ask, I just didn't have the context on what is interesting, how do I learn a topic. And so then, yeah, I guess my curiosity has gotten better over time. I don't know if that answers the basic question of why I let my curiosity lead in the first place. I think it's just one thing where you're just going to be a little cringe when you're starting off, you know, whatever you're doing, you know, you're 18, 19, whatever you do, is just going to, you start a blog. The posts are going to be cringe. If you start a YouTube channel, the first videos that Mr. Beast did, I think he had one where he just said Logan Paul for 24 hours or something. You know what I mean? So that kind of stuff will happen. But then just the best way to learn is just keep doing it and just accept that a lot of things will be embarrassing. And maybe that in a way answers why other people don't learn with their curiosity first, because there is a lot of negative reinforcement in the beginning where you're just not going to be good. And you must have this, I don't know how you feel earlier on in your podcast when you were starting out, when there were tens of people listening or low hundreds or something.
Yeah, it's not much different nowadays.
Right. But I mean, it's like 100, it took me a while to get to that. I think I was even like a year ago or a little over a year ago, I was in that range. So
interesting.
But it just like going from 0 to 100 is like, if you think in a log scale, that's as big a difference as like going from 100 to like 10,000, right? Or 100 to 10,000. Yeah. So I think that just like, there's not a lot of good reinforcement in the beginning when you're just pursuing your curiosity.
To approach the question from a different angle, why is it that you don't concern yourself, and maybe you do, but it's more under the surface, why don't you concern yourself with these other games that people play around status, power, money? That I think is not that curiosity is mutually exclusive from those things, but I think you prioritize one and hope that the other comes. Whereas I think other people are kind of bypassing their curiosity to pursue those other games. Why aren't you doing that?
I wonder if you can bypass those games. I can't think of anybody who is, the people I admire a lot who have achieved things I admire, they still seem to be playing a sort of status game, at least. I think status is the strongest motive. What I've noticed is that's a strong motivation in people, and then the wealth and power are a little less so. But I think they're still playing that game. They just have a better crowd from whom they're trying to attain that status. Like, I definitely wouldn't say that I'm above pursuing status. It's just that hopefully I found people I respect whose status I would covet, or whose respect I would covet. And that, so to the extent that that motivates me, it's hopefully in a positive direction. And then, yeah, maybe it's just a matter of people identifying in the first place who are the people that they should be trying to get approval from.
Right. Molly Milky, I'm not sure if you're familiar with her. She has the moth bun. She was on several episodes ago, and she has this phrase, famous among friends, which I think speaks to this like different perspective on reputation and status, which is identifying that maybe not handful, but that subset of people whose ideas and criticism and, you know, kind of reputation transference you appreciate, and focusing on them rather than the masses. And this is an idea I've been wrestling with as well recently.
Although there's one failure mode there, which I've noticed, I don't know if it's fair to call it a failure, but what happens is people have this idea of the people they know who they want to impress. And so if they have like some ideas, they'll send it to them in a private Google Doc or something, instead of just publishing a blog post or, you know, in our cases, publishing a podcast or something. And the effect of that is that other people can't find you, and you're getting rid of that sort of opportunity to find other people whose respect you would want to earn. Maybe they'll reach out to you like, hey, I really like this. Let's talk. And I found a lot of mentors this way, just people who have like enjoyed my work. And then, you know, we meet up, and now those are the people I'm trying to earn earn respect from. But then you're always releasing stuff publicly, so more and more people can earn that position, you know?
Yeah. You never know who's listening.
They're
throwing your ideas out into the void, or seemingly the void, or the ether, can act as a beacon where other people you never even expected seeing that will kind of swarm to it. I think this also is tangential to your idea of intellectual market makers, which for those who are unfamiliar, and obviously you could give a better description of it than I can, but maybe the simplest explanation is people with more distribution or reach who can amplify an idea from somebody else and kind of arbitrage the space between the quality of the idea and the reach it has. This is a topic I've become fascinated with recently. There's another phrase that the friend Henrik Carlson uses, which is like switchboard operators, or these people who kind of route traffic towards important ideas, important but under-recognized ideas. What would you say are the missing, whether it's cultural or infrastructure, whatever elements, and I, obviously we've gotten better in the age of the internet at amplifying ideas from smaller sources, but what's preventing us from doing that even better today? How could we improve?
I do think it takes a lot of skill to do this well. One thing you'll notice is, as you start to learn more about an area, and you learn the people who initially introduced you to that area, and you think, for example, if they wrote a really good review of a book or something, and you think, oh, these are really interesting ideas they came up with, or a synopsis of a field or something, and then you realize, oh, even they had to, you see their sources. But that takes a lot of skill, right? These kinds of people who are able to compress in a meaningful way, preserving the accuracy and authenticity of the ideas themselves. And it also implies that I think there's, if somebody who's a really good blogger or something, they just started with a different pseudonym, I think that they could very easily regain their audience very fast. I think a lot of the sort of progress we see in, I have X many readers, now I have X times 10 readers and so on, that just them getting better. They already were, if Mr. B started a new YouTube channel, everybody forgot who he was. I think, yeah, he would probably get a million views pretty easily in the first few months of trying. So
interesting.
I think that the skill is probably the main thing.
Actually, I think VisaCon Verisami on Twitter, he said that he started multiple kind of alt accounts that he's gotten to a few thousand followers.
Interesting.
So it's an anecdote in support of that. Going back to kind of curiosity briefly, and then I want to dive more into, like, I think what we just talked about is connected to the idea of talent, which I want to spend a lot of time on. But going back to curiosity for a second, you have, over the course of your podcast and writing, covered topics ranging from talent to economics to AI, more recently, biographies of great people. Is there kind of a through line or an arrow of your curiosity? Like, if you were to distill it into a sentence or two, or are you just really, like, you know, following your gut and saying, no, this week I'm interested in this topic, let's go with it?
Yeah, if you were really cynical, somebody might say, well, this just sounds like the hot topics in Silicon Valley, and I'm just jumping back and forth between them. I can't think of any off the top of my head, honestly. More recently, I've been trying to talk more about topics where I think in 100 years, if I'm trying to predict what the world would look like in the year 2100, will this conversation, will this book, will this paper help me better model the year 2100? And lots of things can be helpful here. Obviously, science and technology will feature heavily there, but understanding society, understanding people, that's also relevant. But then there's certain things you realize this is probably not going to be that helpful. So, and I've been trying to prune down, because I've been thinking carefully about what are the conversations I've learned the most from. And I've realized, especially the scientific and technical ones, the ones about rigorously having these big picture worldviews, they've actually been really helpful, where other ones have been less so, where they're more fluffy, they're more philosophical, they're more vibes-based, those haven't been as fruitful. So the recent stuff about AI, for example, has been along that line of having a better role model.
I think that encapsulates it well. I mean, even the more recent stuff around, you know, like reading all the biographies of Lyndon Johnson and moderating that conversation on AI regulation, politics, it all fits underneath that. Interesting. How do you decide, and you're still so young, so maybe you're not at that point yet, but how do you decide when to kind of keep your perspective or like your aperture open versus like narrow it and focus in on something? Because it's easy to jump from topic to topic. It's also, I think I'm kind of indirectly getting into like the hill climbing question here of like, what you could go all in on AI tomorrow, which I think would be a worthy pursuit, worthy use of your time. But say it's something else like biographies and you reach this local maxima too early. How do you know when to like focus on breadth versus depth?
That's a good question.
And I ask this at the risk of like, maybe you don't need to overanalyze it like that. Maybe it is just, you know, continue to follow your intuition, as trite as that sounds. And eventually you'll look back and see these consistent trends. There's a directional.
Yeah. I think, so one thing is you definitely don't want to avoid depth, but you want to avoid the failure mode where you know a lot about something very specific, but can't fit that together in a comprehensive model of what's going on and what's going to happen. And what is helpful and what I'm hoping I can do is maybe do clusters of episodes or clusters of posts where I go deep into AI, and then maybe next time I'll go deep into, we'll see what, right? Like I've done with these clusters on economics before. On business history, I did, you mentioned the biography, and then I had an episode about a historian on, you know, Napoleon. So there are these little clusters. I think that will be a good mixture of breadth and depth if I can just do a month or two on this particular topic and then keep routing that way.
I think that's a both for you and for listeners an enjoyable model, especially for those who consider themselves kind of like aspiring polymaths or generalists, to get exposure to a number of different fields at once.
I hope so.
It feels like you're trying to work towards this, maybe not, you know, theory of everything, but you want to create better mental models or better maps of the world and where it's headed.
Yeah.
How have your maps and maybe particular maps evolved over the course of the last year or two as you've been having these conversations and doing researching and writing?
The main change, and this one is pretty cliche at this point, and everybody will say this, but the main one is the centrality of transformative AI within the coming, you know, years or, you know, decades. And that's why a lot of the episodes have been about AI recently. I think this is you always have to have a probability distribution over things, but there's a lot of things that we could go into the weeds or anything, but just like big picture, it seems like this could happen. If it did, it would be a huge deal, and it seems making sure it goes right. Other than that, what are the big changes to my role? The bigger sort of meta change is focusing more on science and tech and on these kinds of quantitative rigorous models versus the more vibes-based stuff, the more culture actually probably is the right way to describe it. More vague philosophy, moving away from that.
Why? Because it's less practical? It's more theoretical?
Yeah. What is the shift? And have you met these people who have like read a lot of these, I'm not even talking about the great philosophers or something, but just like these pop philosophers or these modern cultural writers, and they don't know shit. You know, you talk to them and you're thinking like, what is the use of all the shit you're reading? So I don't want to end up like that. And when I talk to people who understand a lot about the quantitative aspects of the world and have thought really rigorously, developed taxonomies of different problems and different ideas, done all the Fermi estimates, and I'm really impressed with them. So I want to be more like them.
Let's go down the rabbit hole, the AI rabbit hole for a minute. Where did you start? I'll ask two separate questions. Let's start with this one. Where did you start in regards to your kind of optimism or skepticism about AI, and how has that evolved over the course of your, you know, several conversations with leading experts and researchers?
Yeah. So there's been a few big updates here. I would identify one moment where this started as me preparing to interview Holden Karnofsky, who was then the head of the Open Philanthropy charity, which is, they have like tens of billions of dollars that they're giving out to what they identify as the most, you know, useful causes, the most effective causes. And him being in charge of such a sum has decided that making sure AI goes well is worth dedicating those tens of billions of dollars to, or a large fraction of that money to. And so he didn't have this view before he got into charity in the first place, because he was concerned about global well-being, you know, poverty in the developing world and so on. So then talking to him about how he's thought about this, how he sees the grand picture of history as accelerating growth, where we end up in this crazy time we're in now, which leads to AI. And then you all have all these other pieces of evidence that add in together about how much compute we're putting into these AI models as compared to how much compute it took to develop the human mind. You just go through all these arguments. Anyway, so that was a big update. Then talking to Eliezer Yudkowsky and realizing that he had a lot of, you know, I'm preparing for the conversation, I always try to have a Socratic dialogue where I try to challenge them, and realizing that he actually, there's no point where I could just like knock down his arguments. You can listen to it and you can decide if I was convinced or not. I wasn't completely convinced of his views either. But there's no point where he's like obviously ridiculous. You have to give him his due. So that was a big update. Talking to Ilya Sutskever, who is the chief scientist at OpenAI, the chief researcher, and realizing how this guy, who for the last 10 years has basically seen the advances in AI coming, has seen that if you just make these models bigger and bigger, they grow more and more intelligent, more and more powerful. How he's thinking about, this is going to happen as well. And are you going to really dismiss a guy like that? And most recently, interviewing Carl Shulman, who probably my favorite episodes, or the clump of episodes we released in two parts because it was an 8-hour episode, and having who has this incredibly rigorous model of an intelligence explosion that I found pretty compelling.
One of the ongoing debates, but there a few months ago was a particular point in time where this was heavily debated, was whether we should take a 6-month break to focus on AI regulation and develop it in a more quote unquote ethical manner. And there's a number of responses as to why we shouldn't do that, ranging from national interests. China isn't going to do that. There's like a kind of beginning of infinity argument around, we don't know what we don't know about AI. So how could we possibly kind of regulate it? How has your opinion about regulation in particular changed? And is AI kind of research and regulation futile as a field, to put it plainly?
Yeah, this is something I still don't have an opinion on that I'm willing to say, like, oh, this is my opinion. I have considerations on it. I have intuitions. One is, I'm a libertarian, so usually I'm very much against regulation, whereas in this case, I'm more open to it. And the logic of it would be that if we hit a point where AGI is just around the corner, then having a period in which the best alignment techniques can be tested out and implemented, and making sure all the I's are crossed, all the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed, would be a helpful thing to do. It doesn't seem we're at that point now, so it's not clear to me what a pause right now would achieve. But I'm definitely open to it in the future.
Although AI has kind of become synonymous about, or the most discussed topic around futurism, there's a lot of other stuff happening in the space. What outside of AI, what are some of the other kind of future advancements you're thinking about, spending a lot of time, maybe outside the podcast or writing, thinking about? And do you have any controversial or kind of contested opinions about the future state of things?
Sure. Definitely. Who doesn't? Well, I think the big thing is, either through AI or through gene editing, I think we're going to get things that are much smarter than the average human. I interviewed on my podcast about a year ago, Steve Hsu, who is this geneticist, he's a theoretical physicist who then started an embryo selection company. And embryo selection is a process by which basically when you're doing IVF, you have a bunch of different embryos, like 5 or so, that you select one of which to implant into the mother. And in this case, you just run a test on them, get a polygenic score where you score them on health or something. And you select, instead of just randomly putting one in, you select the one which is highest rated on this score. And through this process, you can also look for correlations in intelligence and choose the embryo that is most likely to be more intelligent. You repeat this process iteratively, and you do it once, then with if you can repeat it, then you have something that is potentially many standards of deviation higher than what the average random sample would have been. So it seems like with technologies like that, or you can just avoid all of this with just doing CRISPR and just like editing the alleles you know to be important for intelligence directly. Yeah, when you get to that point, I mean, obviously that's going to matter. Then there's the other things which people have noticed for sure, I'm guessing, you know, things like fusion. You might think any particular fusion effort is not that likely to work, but all of them not working, that seems unlikely. The space stuff seems big, right? The fact that the cost of launching something into orbit over the last 10-20 years has declined by a factor of, by an entire order of magnitude, so it's 10x cheaper to send a pound into space. I think that's going to end up mattering a lot, not just for science, but also for defense and other kinds of things. Where, you know, the Reagan Star Wars program to shoot down any Soviet nuclear missiles coming towards us, that was like a joke at the time, and it's like something we could do now. What are some other technologies that are I'm sure there's like a long list if we just went through it, but those are some of the things that come to mind.
And any particularly controversial opinions you have about either any of those or about the future state of things, however many decades down the road?
One is, if we have AI, I keep asking people who are thinking about this, and I don't think I've gotten a really good answer of how are humans. The entire idea behind alignment is that, you know, humans should be in charge. And once you have gods, are you really saying humans will still be in charge? Should they be in charge? So I haven't gotten a good answer on that from any of my guests. And this is not, I don't have an opinion on here per se, except for the fact that the way in which people express a post-AGI future for humans just often doesn't make sense to me. Are we just hoping for a retirement home? Yeah. Like, what is the goal here?
Yeah. I think that was one of the central kind of pushbacks you had in your critique of Mark Andreessen's piece, was you can't simultaneously say that AGI is going to have godlike or superhuman-like powers and yet still going to be under the control or like the dominion of humans. Those things are somewhat at odds. Okay, I've been wanting to get back to talent. So I want to dive in there.
Let's do it.
I guess to start us off, and in I think the first three out of the first five of your essays on your Substack and a couple of your early podcast conversations dealt with this topic of talent. Why were you initially interested in or drawn to that space or that topic?
Well, I think it was probably a sort of clear, you know, you write about yourself kind of thing. And at the time, yeah, I was thinking of how do I find opportunities? How do I get noticed? Those kinds of things. And so from there, it was kind of a natural topic to be thinking about. And I was also really interested in people like Bernd Hobart, who were developing like financial metaphors for life and analogies there. And so then that spawned a few ideas about, you can think of talent as options, you can think of talent as leverage, stuff like that.
How have you, which of those kind of ideas or philosophies did you incorporate back into or apply to your own life and found extremely effective? Like, what one from an outside perspective is this idea of options. You did a thing in podcasting that kind of broke away from the mold or the traditional approach of just entering the workforce, which if somebody was to invest in, you know, the average mid-level manager coming out of college, there's pretty steady returns there. The thing you did either could have gone to zero or it could have outsized returns like it has. Whether digging into that more, talking about some of the other ideas you came across, which ones did you find particularly useful or influential?
Yeah, this is related to the option thing. I think people tend to overestimate how much people care about normal things. And I don't know if maybe you've had this experience when you're hiring people, for young people, for internships or something like that. Or maybe you've just like heard people talk about this, I'm sure you've actually had this experience, given the things you worked on, where people will have on their resume things like, I was the president of so-and-so, or I had a GPA 3.7 instead of 3.6. Those are lower than average examples, but, and yeah, you just don't care, right? And then the thing you care about is the thing they might have thought that they are wasting their time on. In the case of computer science, the thing I was studying, just like a really cool open source project you made, a really cool blog post. I was hiring a producer, and the people who were like super talented people applied, a bunch of them. And the things that were super compelling was not, I worked for this person before, I did this thing. It was just like, just send me your website. Do you have some like really interesting thoughts on there? Have you done something really cool? People tend to underestimate the value of just, yeah, that kind of shock factor.
Why is that? Is it just because all the models around us point to, like, as you're going through school, I feel like from the time we're, call it, you know, 12 or 13, the goal is get good grades, you can get into a decent college, you can get into a decent job. It feels like risk mitigation more than like exploring the ceiling. Is it like the fear of failure, or I mean, I'm sure it is to some degree, but curious why more people don't think in this like way of outliers.
Yeah. Maybe one thing is they don't realize they have nothing to lose, right? And if you're in college or something, like, what are you worried about? If you, right. It depends on what kind of thing you're trying to do, but if you just maybe got a B instead of an A, but instead spend that time working on a really cool project or going to office hours with the professor or to get really deep on something, and then that leads to a research paper or something. But then some other marginal part of your curriculum suffers. That doesn't matter, right? The thing that an option in finance is just you only get the value of the thing if it increases in value beyond a certain point. Otherwise, you can kind of just forget about it. And I think you should just think of your life this way. Like, nobody gives a shit about these marginal things you're doing. The thing that matters is the thing that really stands out, the digging the hole that goes like 20 feet deep instead of a bunch of 5 foot deep holes.
And I think importantly that the one place where maybe that analogy of an option falls short in a good way is that although as a financial instrument, the contract might expire and that's it. In the case of your life, you can start over again in 5 years or 10 years ago and do something else.
That's actually a really good point. Yep.
Zooming out within the talent space for a second, and we've already started to touch on this, but a problem I've thought a lot about recently and actually over the course of like the last 7 months with Delt personally is the labor market or hiring. Mm-hmm. I went without a job for like 6 months, was applying to a bunch of jobs I thought I was qualified for, many of which I didn't even want. And it seems like there's a lot of inefficiency within hiring. And as somebody who hasn't, at least I don't think you have had like a traditional job, maybe you haven't had enough hands-on experience with this to have an opinion, but do you have any hypotheses about improvements or experiments we should be running to improve, I'll call it generally, like talent and organization or talent to talent matchmaking?
From the perspective of the person applying or from the perspective of the person offering?
That's a great question. I think that's one of the things, let's go from either end if you have ideas for both.
From the perspective of the person applying, this has been impressed upon me the last few weeks when I've been hiring a producer, just that they won't notice these marginal things. They're going to notice the one standout thing that's really cool. So really hammering home that like takeaway detail that will be memorable to them among the dozens of candidates. Kyle Newport has a good example of this with regards to college applications, where he says, you think these elite universities were going to care that you were president of your National Honor Society? The thing they care about is you had this awesome blog about the Supreme Court or something that got you on NPR while you were in high school, or you started, there's other things you can do there, but something that really stands out like that. And from the case of the person evaluating, I guess this is what advice would I give myself a few weeks ago? maybe the converse problem is if people are not bringing out that side of themselves, that's the exceptional side, when they keep hammering home the message or the aspects that they think are the things people are supposed to care about because that's what they've been emphasizing. Just in an interview or in the way in which you phrase the application, giving them the opportunity. One of the questions I put on the forum for the producer, the people who applied for producer, was, what is the most impressive thing you've done? Just like giving them the opportunity to hammer home the coolest thing they've done or the coolest abilities they have.
It's a fascinating point I haven't spent a lot of time thinking about, which is, and maybe I'm splicing in my own kind of interpretation of this, but both the individual and the organization are looking in most cases for a single fit, right? You want to find one company to work for, you want to find one individual to fill this role. And the the best way to signal if you're the right person or the right organization for that is to talk about that one thing that makes you different, that you're obsessed with, that you can do better. Yep. All the rest of it is just noise that's common across every organization, every yep. individual. So maybe that's the best way to increase efficiency.
Yeah. In fact, maybe another thing to add from the perspective of the person evaluating or recruiting is that talent is not just a thing that you evaluate in others, but is evaluated in you. Why would somebody who is really talented, why should they work for you? Why should they work with you? So having that in your mind, what is the value proposition you're bringing, and being able to signal your own talent is important if you're recruiting.
I think we don't do enough job externalizing those kinds of questions in general, whether it's like something as simple as in preparing for this conversation with you. I might think I came up with a good question, but did I ask it back to myself in a way that I could come up with a good answer? Or did I just come up with a question that sounded good? The same goes for a lot of cases in life. Since those early essays on talent, you kind of steered towards a number of different topics, which we've touched on. Have you developed any other ideas or opinions about the talent space since then that you haven't had a chance to write about or talk about?
Not really. Just general things that you would find in other places as well. The importance of kind of being, for lack of a better word, a savage in the sense of just really going out. If there's an opportunity you're really interested in, really going after it, not treating it casually, doing whatever it takes in some sense, you know, send them the emails. I actually really appreciated it, and I apologize for being not immediately responsive to you, but I really appreciated the way in which you kept following up on the scheduling for this interview, and
the way that
I've had to do that too with certain guests. But that's kind of what people assume I guess that can come up as pushy, but if it does, then you weren't going to get it anyway. So what do you have to lose? But just especially for people who I'm trying to reach out to who are busy, just how important it is to keep hammering home, getting interest from everybody that they know I know. It does take a little bit of chutzpah and forced repetitions.
I wanted to dig a little bit into kind of content creation and the research process that goes into that. I think you are as good as anybody at researching your guest. I mean, for the topic you're writing about, for the Lyndon Johnson biographies, for example, like you read, was there 4 volumes of them?
Yeah.
That's thousands of pages. You don't like half-ass your research. And I think it shows in the quality of the conversations and the outputs. What exactly is, other than just like consuming everything that you possibly can get your hands on, what's the rest of your research process? What do you think makes for good research?
This is a thing that's top of my mind because I only started it recently. Spaced repetition. And I started this in response to my most recent conversation with Andy Matushak, where I think back on all the things I've forgotten over the years from all these conversations I've done and the information I've sort of wasted in the research I initially did to interview somebody who's a world expert in something. So anyways, that was just top of mind. But more generally, what is the thing that helps me with our research? Not making excuses for, I only need to understand it at a superficial level because I'm doing the interview, and therefore I just need to read the article about it or something. Maybe the actual technical depth won't come out in the interview, although you'd be surprised at how often it does come up when I've done interviews and it comes up in the follow-up or something. Technical might not be the right word for what I'm looking for, but just like, I mean details. I mean actually understanding it. If it's a historian, then actually understanding the period, not just having a sort of superficial understanding enough that you can ask vague questions. So that understanding is super useful. And it's the entire point. Like, if you're not going to do that, what are you getting away from the podcast?
Right.
At least that's how I think myself. if I'm not going to go through the trouble of really internalizing their ideas beforehand, what was the point of doing that episode? So yeah, just being willing to go deep.
I think you're hinting at the motivations we talked earlier about, you know, playing status games. Motivations for a lot of people might just be, I want to get in a room or in a Zoom with this person. They care less about, you know, the research and the content of the conversation. Yeah. What would you say is the anatomy of or blueprint of, and there's two things, you can either tackle both or one, of a good question, which is kind of the atomic unit of the second part of this question, which is a good interview.
Mm-hmm. A good question. One of the things I've realized, it should be specific. Vague questions don't often elicit good answers, and also tend to, an interviewer who is an expert in something, who is an expert in something, will assume that, because they talk to a lot of different people, and most of the people they get interviewed by are stupid, so then they'll assume you're like the other people they've been interviewed by, unless you give them the signal, like, no, I know my shit. Here's the specific way in which I'm asking this question to show you I know my shit. So give me a specific answer in response, or give me a good answer in response. Asking questions that you actually care to know the answer to. Like, do you really care? People will ask questions like, what was it like growing up in the Midwest? Like, who the fuck cares? Like, that's what you wanted to ask this guy? You don't want to ask about his business, his ideas. You want to know what it was like growing up in the Midwest? Not asking questions which they've explicitly answered elsewhere. It depends on what kind of podcast. I mean, some are just like general interest podcasts. So sometimes the goal of the podcast is to help you introduce your ideas to an audience. And sometimes that's necessary for a novel question, for you to just get that context into the head of the audience so you can proceed. But not basically prompting them the entire episode to repeat the introductory chapter of their book. Yeah, things along those lines.
Yeah, in regards to the second one, I don't know if you've heard of or played with AirChat yet, Naval's new app. But I asked him this question on there, and he gave a very similar answer, which is, ask questions you actually give a shit about. why are you spending time on things, like you said, that have been answered elsewhere, or that, you know, you've got limited time with this individual? Why not ask the things that are going to be most applicable to and impactful on your life? And I've struggled with that as well, because there are those kind of like hot button questions that you would love to ask. And there's also, you have to the point of research, you have to do quite a bit of research to go and figure out, what have they already been asked? How can I reformulate this in a way that they haven't been asked before? So it's difficult work. As a result of you kind of doubling down on podcasting, you've kind of pressed on the brakes a little bit with your writing. Why did you make the decision to focus on podcasting? I mean, I say that, and you just published like a, I think it was like a 30-minute read. So you are still doing both, but why have you stepped on the brakes, and how do you know when to kind of channel your creative output into which medium?
Well, the podcasting was because I realized I needed to learn from these experts first before I try to develop my own ideas. But now I think that I should be doing more writing relative to what I've been doing. And I think it's for practical reasons with regards to people. It's easier for people to share you and your content if they know who you are. Like, what's a Lunar Society? Who is this guy?
Yeah.
He asks good questions. That's not a good sort of selling point for somebody who doesn't know who you are. Whereas if it's like, he has this interesting ideas about X, Y, or Z, you can read his blog post about it, and he happens to do these interviews, then you've got to start. So for that reason, but also I think it is very useful for developing a role model where you force yourself to write rebuttals or reviews or things like that. Writing is really helpful. And so I'm going to be doing more of that.
So do you see podcasting, is it fair to characterize it, or maybe the inputs to podcasting, like the research, as well as listening back to episodes, kind of inputs to or like fuel for your writing, where you might remix or come up with your own ideas on top of that as a funnel of sorts?
Yeah, absolutely. I wrote a rebuttal to Mark Andreessen's AI post, and that was a lot of ideas funneled from the previous guest, which was Carl Schulman, things like that. So absolutely, it's you're basically being a market maker between your guest and your writing.
Very meta commentary there. what is the so you occupy this space of like content creator, intellectual, although you maybe don't describe yourself as that. And I've always been fascinated by Scott Adams' idea of like skill stack, or like what is the intersection of or the combination of skills where you could be world class at. What is the skill stack that you feel like you're closest to number one in the world at?
I wouldn't say closest to number one at, but the obvious answer is asking good questions, but that's not a stack. So what would the stack be?
I think it's a stack underlying it.
Yeah. Well, maybe learning about subjects pretty fast, or not learning the whole thing, but learning quite a bit. Understanding what is the interesting part of that subject? What would be the part that's fun to talk about? Being sensitive to that. Being sensitive to what field to get into in the first place. Yeah, I guess a lot of it is tacit. And I'm also getting better at it all the time. So I don't feel like this is something I've mastered. I hope. And I would be very disappointed if in a few months I'm still as good. Like, so, you know, this is a stack I'm still trying to improve on.
Yeah. I don't think it'll be the case that you're still as good as you are now in 3 months. Awesome. Well, there's one question I like to ask all guests in closing, which is to flip it back on you. What's one question you'd leave me and listeners with to think about or act on?
I guess one of the things we talked about was developing that one project or that one, depending on different contexts, that one standout blog or other thing you're doing which stands out to people. Like, what is that for you? And you know, if you're starting out relatively early, it's okay if it's cringe. One of the main purposes is to just show people you have the initiative and the motivation to seek those kinds of things out yourself and to do them. But what is that? And if you don't have one, why aren't you making it?
A great call to action. Dwarkesh, thank you so much for your time. This was a blast. And I really enjoyed listening to the different conversations you were part of, reading your stuff leading up to this. And it's pretty cool to be at this early kind of in your story. So looking forward to following along in the future.
Yeah, man, this is a pleasure, dude. You asked great questions. And this is, it was like a, you know, like a free therapy session or something.
Thank you.